We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 34, Hogwarts Forever. For joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Lori Beckoff and Marissa Osman about the unofficial Harry Potter Hogwarts Handbook, MuggleNet recently published. I am Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, Instructor of Comparative Religions and Cultural Competence at Mount Carmel College, and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today, we are exploring all the corners of our favorite school of witchcraft and wizardry, Hogwarts, of course. Now, Emily, if you were a Hogwarts student, where do you think you would be spending most of your time?
Well, this is a really interesting question because I actually got to do something very Hogwartsian when I was in undergrad. I went to the University of Evansville. And I think in around the 1970s, Evansville bought a British manor house from Stanford, actually, for a song, apparently, because, you know, these things are apparently expensive to keep up. So Evansville bought it, sold most of the furniture to, you know, help maintain it. And then, so I heard, and then they turned it into a branch campus. And so those of us who attended Evansville got to transfer to Harlaxton, which is what the manor house is called, for a semester and continue our studies with no disruption to our, you know, curriculum. So we got this like cool travel experience for the semester, and we got to live, and it was in the north of England. It's kind of near Grantham, which is near Nottingham. So I can answer your question from some experience because I got to live in a castle for a semester, which was super fun.
And it was very really, Hogwartsian, huh?
It was very Hogwartsian. In fact, they filmed couple of episodes of the masterpiece show Victoria at the Harlaxton College, and so it was really neat. It was so cool because in the episode, like, you could even hear the way that the sound is in those rooms, in the large estate rooms and stuff, and it was just so much great nostalgia for me. But I will tell you that what I did as a sophomore, I would, you know, I love to do my homework, as I'm sure you did too, okay? It's always fun. So especially in that kind of a setting. So I would just kind of wander around. So if you wandered long enough, anywhere you went, you would kind of turn a corner and there'd be this really cool little nook with like a little love seat, and you could just spread your books out and get some homework done, and maybe some people would pass by, but it was relatively private. And I remember there was this one place with these, it was like kind of a bay stained glass window, and somebody had pushed a baby grand piano into it, and I just would sit there for hours playing piano and in this really amazing setting. I think if I was a Hogwarts student, I would be exploring. I'd probably get very lost and end up getting in trouble and probably eaten by something very hairy. But I would be looking for those little nooks and crannies to do my homework in. What about you, Katie?
I love that. Yeah, I picture you wandering ghost-like through the corridors and
very
running
ghost-like
into the Bloody Baron or Peeves or something like that. Yeah, so, you know, mine was much more mundane. I was like, of course, I would enjoy the library. And I'm pretty sure I'd be trying to get in the restricted section.
Oh, yeah.
I was a rule follower, but like for books, I think I'd want to see the books. And then the other thing, I was like, you know, I'm pretty sure I'd be hanging out in the Great Hall for some snacks.
Oh, sure.
package.
Yeah. Sneaking into the kitchens. The
Yeah,
Weasley twins.
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so many cool little spots in Hogwarts and on the grounds of Hogwarts. And we are going to explore all of those things about Hogwarts that we are fascinated by, that we are drawn to. We are joined in our discussion of all things Hogwarts by Lori Beckhoff and Marissa Osman, two of the authors of a new unofficial Harry Potter Hogwarts handbook just out last year. Lori Beckhoff is campaign manager at MuggleNet and the producer of Potterversity podcast. She received her bachelor's degree from the University of Chicago and master's in medieval literatures and cultures from the University of Edinburgh, focusing on medievalism in Harry Potter. And Marissa Osman is an author and academic researching literature, culture, and pedagogy. She did her undergraduate degree at University of Kentucky and her master's at King's College London, and she has been with MuggleNet since 2017. Welcome to you both, Lori and Marissa.
Thank you for having me.
Always happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And, you know, I feel like Hogwarts, this is a place that we, you know, we feel that we know something about, but maybe we could know more. We could know more. Well, Marissa, we know a fair amount about Lori's Harry Potter journey, but how did you first discover the Harry Potter books? And what led you to take them seriously as literature?
It's interesting because of my age, I fall into that nice sweet spot of growing up with the books, but I actually didn't. I didn't really discover Potter until I was in my late teens. And even then, I watched the movies before I read the books.
Oh!
Yeah, it definitely gives me sort of a unique perspective, considering a lot of the fandom that participates really heavily usually come to it through the books first. And so it was when I was driving back and forth to classes during my undergrad that I was listening to the audiobooks for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was spending all of those hours listening to them, everything felt so relevant to the things I was learning. So I was being exposed to, you know, very serious critical thinking and analytical like theories and things like that. And I would find myself applying that sort of logic to the Potter books. And I've been obsessed with doing that ever since.
That's great. I definitely feel like I resonate with that. I'm fascinated that you came to the books through the movies. Did you start with the first movie or did you even like watch a later one and have to go back?
I actually wish I remember the answer to that. I don't. If I had to guess, I would say that I probably saw movie 5 or 6, possibly with my dad, who's a big fan of fantasy or sci-fi movies. And then I would have gone back to the first.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Laurie and Marissa, we talked a little bit about your academic backgrounds in the introduction, but how did you draw on your academic studies? Marissa, you've already kind of touched on this just a little bit, but how did you draw on your academic work for this particular project? And do you tend to bring your academic side into your participation with fandom? Laurie, why don't we start with you?
Well, I think the answer is kind of obvious for me about whether I bring my academic side into the fandom. There's this little podcast I produce.
We know. We set you up.
And I also made an academic section called Muggle Studies on MuggleNet that's got an academic bibliography and some other resources for people looking to do academic research on Harry Potter. So it's very much in the work I do for MuggleNet. But for this particular project, I definitely took it upon myself as a medievalist by training to talk about some of the medieval influences on Hogwarts, which is a medieval school. It was founded, you know, theoretically about 1,000 years ago. So I knew there had to be some medieval connection. So I did have three particular bits in this book that I couldn't help myself and decided to stick in some medieval stuff. So I wrote about Hagrid's hut. And put in some information about resemblance between him and the Green Man,
the Green Man,
medieval
yes.
figure.
Oh, nice.
Which, if you've been to the theme park and been to the in Florida and been to Hagrid's magical motorbike adventure, you'll notice that there are a lot of green men in the architecture leading up to it. Nice. So there's definitely a connection there. I also wrote the section about wizard chess. We did do an episode where I talked about, or maybe it's an upcoming episode. Maybe we haven't released it yet. Talking about a paper I wrote for the Chestnut Hill Conference on games in Harry Potter, including chess. So I couldn't help but include a little bit about some Arthurian magical chess games that might have influenced wizard chess. And then I also wrote the part on Sir Cadogan. And had to talk a little bit about Don Quixote and Pelennor in T.H. White's The Once and Future King as some potential inspiration for a bumbling knight that we see in Sir Cadogan. So yeah, I definitely took it upon myself to look at some medieval influences I could talk about in this.
Nice.
Yeah, that's really cool. And, you know, one of the things that I noticed was in each school section, there's sort of like famous Ravenclaws, famous Gryffindors, and there's some medieval stuff that gets in there as well. So that was pretty cool.
That part wasn't even me. It's infused into Hogwarts as a medieval institution, right? So it got into, I think, everyone's minds a little bit.
Marissa, you mentioned that Harry Potter, listening to Harry Potter for the first time, was really dovetailing with your academic studies. So how did that manifest in this project?
A lot of what I tried to do with the sections that I wrote was to keep it very academic focused and detailed, especially, but I wanted to make sure it was palatable to a wide variety of ages and backgrounds, because when you're presented with a thick book full of just blocks and blocks of information, that's a lot to take in. And a lot of what I study involves intersections of like popular culture and literary canon. And so it's no secret that a lot of times we just sort of skim over things that aren't very interesting to us. And I wanted to make sure that everything I was writing was interesting in some way.
We are also interested in, you know, the approachable part of, you know, the kind of analytic or academic side of the fandom.
Yeah, and accessibility.
And one of the things that, you know, maybe we should mention before we go too much farther is that this is a really pretty book. It's actually beautifully laid out, and it's so readable, and it has these little sidebars. There's like a timeline that shows you the Battle of Hogwarts, and it's just it's a beautiful, beautiful book. And I do think it's visually appealing.
Definitely. Yeah, I completely agree.
And you can get a whole set of them. This is part of our series that MuggleNet has of unofficial reference books. And so they're all in the same style with a different color accent, the bestiary, spellbook, and character compendium. So you can have a lovely, beautiful set that all
That's
go together.
That's great. Yeah, and very affordable, but really nice looking books. So Laurie and Marissa, tell us, how did the idea for this particular project come about? How did you decide to do the unofficial Harry Potter Hogwarts handbook?
I feel like it's a natural step in writing a sort of collection like these books are for us, because obviously in the Harry Potter universe, there's Hogwarts a history. And so we wanted to make sure that that was something we could replicate, in the sense that we're providing all of this information about Hogwarts in one place.
Yeah, I think that definitely was, Hogwarts of History was getting thrown around a lot when we were, I think, brainstorming other ideas for books, because the other couple in this series are mostly more like glossary index style, where each one very much has an entry. Like here, it's a list of different characters or different beasts or different spells. And this was, you know, much more like nebulous idea that wasn't necessarily as much of a list of certain things, but it was, you know, the book that we'd probably all want to read in the wizarding world is Hogwarts a History. So it seemed like the next step for where we had to go.
You know, on the episode where we talked about what books from the wizarding world did we most want to read, mine was Hogwarts a History, definitely. And I think, you know, you're talking about the other books are more encyclopedic, you know, and this one has a nice handbook kind of feel, but it's very readable. I definitely think you can troll around in it. You can look up the things you're most interested in, but you can also just page through and find lots of little treasures. And I do want to also mention before going too much farther that there were other authors who contributed as well. Jennifer Creevy, Lucy DeMuth, and Sophia Jenkins. And the five of you just did a wonderful job with this.
Thank you. It was very much a group effort. not just at the writing of different sections, but when we came into the editing section of really helping each other fact check and that we were consistent between sections, it was definitely a help to have a group of us really putting our heads together on some of these parts.
Oh, it's just very nice to not only have it from an editing standpoint, but I suppose from the creative side as well. So as we would all read through the different stages of the finished version, we would bring up to each other, should this maybe be phrased in a different way? Is that necessarily true? Is that something that we want to discuss further? And I felt like it was made a much more interesting book because we all contributed to it collectively rather than if one person had worked on it alone.
Well, that's probably pretty emblematic of fan interest in Hogwarts itself. So why do you think that fans want to know more about Hogwarts? Like, what is it about this place that garners so much curiosity?
I feel like it's sort of a natural curiosity because anytime we enjoy something, even casually, but especially people who enjoy something in a way that they participate in the fandom, you really want to know more. You're eager to learn details that you may have missed the first time, which is why we reread things. Maybe you're eager to discuss theories and different contexts behind things. And so when you have a book, several books of fiction, like this entire universe set mostly in one building, you're of course going to be very naturally curious about that. And it doesn't help that it's just the most beautiful, fascinating, unique, almost conscious building. I just love it.
Oh, I love that. It's conscious.
I think for so many of us, when we think about, you know, the feeling that Harry Potter gives us, it always comes back to Hogwarts is my home. Mm-hmm. And that's the place that we associate, you know, the vast majority of the action takes place there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just like, that's our, if someone says, envision Harry Potter, you see the castle, whether it's the inside or the outside, that's, you know, is really at the heart of the series.
You know, I always thought that Harry would end up back at Hogwarts.
Yes, as
like the
don't
defense
get
against
me
the
started,
dark arts
Katie.
Teacher. Oh,
Katie,
oh.
He never should. This is one of my hot takes that I don't even think is very hot because I think it's a very obvious take that Harry never should have been an Auror, or maybe he was an Auror for just a little while to help with, you know, more of the reconstruction of the Wizarding World. And then he should have become the defense against the dark arts professor. He was so happy teaching the DA. Hogwarts was the only place he ever felt like home. Why would he want to go to the ministry? Harry belongs back at Hogwarts.
Maybe someday, though. Maybe someday, you know, maybe because I mean, like that, you know, that kind of post is even more a person is more valuable candidate if they've spent some time, you know, besides saving the world, actually doing the everyday, you know, in the field. So maybe he's there now. Maybe he's
okay.
There now.
Yes. I accept it. Yeah. I can accept it. He's there.
Well, there's a lot of information about Hogwarts in this book. How did you all decide which bits to highlight? What were the things that you really wanted people to be able to see as they were reading through the book?
I think that that question is sort of symbolic of our feelings when we were discussing it, because really there isn't a way to decide what is going to go in there and what isn't. I think that our goal was to include every single parcel of knowledge we had, every single detail, but in a way that is readable and fun and engaging. So that was really difficult and satisfying to see it come together at the end, because that's the thing. We had to include it all.
Yeah, we had this sort of giant spreadsheet where we were listing out every potential topic that might need to be talked about and how many pages we think it would take. So I think we started with the kind of obvious, like, well, we'd have to talk about the common rooms and all the different rooms we know about in Hogwarts. And we'd have to talk about each of the houses and their history a little bit. But then we got into the like, oh, do we also talk about the grounds? Do we also go into Hogsmeade because it's kind of an extension of Hogwarts? And then we should talk we have a character compendium, but we should talk a little bit about the inhabitants, you know, the teachers and the ghosts and things like that. And we should talk about the curriculum itself and basically every aspect of student life. So I think it kind of grew bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, but I love all that. I loved seeing like you had a schedule. So like, here's your class schedule and here are the kind of classes you can take and the electives and here's where the classrooms are. And I loved all of that. It helped me to get in the in the mindset of, you know, maybe this would be my, you know, my handbook for school when I get
to Hogwarts. Some of it is stuff that, like, it's convenient to have a way to look up like that, because as we discovered writing it, some of this stuff, it's so spread out through mm-hmm. the text. Mm. So things like I did the section on classes and, you know, what they do in every single class. And it's not as easy as, you know, getting a PDF and doing, you know, control F and finding mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. every time the word herbology is said, because sometimes it doesn't say herbology. It right. just says booba tubers or something like right. that. And it's, oh, while they're having this important conversation, they happen to be doing this thing in a class.
Right. Right.
And it's like, oh, but now we know that that's what fifth years do in herbology.
There are also a lot of interesting sections of the castle that don't seem like they would be interesting. I wrote a section on the different corridors, and mm-hmm. It's the hallway is what it is. And you don't think that there would be pages of information about a hallway, but when you read the descriptions or the events that take place, there are a lot of things that you can piece together about which corridors lead where, and maybe were those corridors there literally? Did they make sense being there, like geographically within the castle? Were they there for a bit of a plot device? And so that mm-hmm. was really interesting to piece together.
And one of the biggest challenges when we started realizing that nothing makes sense in Hogwarts, and it's a combination of the author not being very good at numbers and remembering where she put things, but also, is that just for magic? That it's just... changing, like, the number of times we realized that ground floor and first floor, it, like, so the term first floor, the floor numbers are said the same between the UK and US versions. You know, the room requirement is always on the seventh floor, no matter which version you read. But seventh floor means something different in the UK and in the US.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we came to realize that, oh, is this thing on the first floor or on the ground floor?
Right.
And so things like that, we trying to map out certain things became just, oh, yikes. Maybe
literally
none of this actually
a moving target
makes sense here. And like, Marissa, I had so much respect for you working on the corridor section because I have a terrible sense of direction. So I was so glad I did not have any of the sections that involved figuring out where things were. And I had the utmost respect for my co-writers who did.
Thank you. I drew a literal map. I got out pen and paper because I'm very digital. I prefer to do all my notes and writing and everything digital, but I got out a pen and paper and I drew a map so that I could visualize it, because that's the thing, is you can't sort of give justifications for what you're writing. So with the corridors, but also for one of the classrooms, there's an inconsistency of whether or not the office for the professor of that class is on the second or third floor or something like that. And I wanted to write so badly that here's why I thought it was this versus this, but you can't do that. Mm-hmm. You would be there all day. You would have a 10,000 page book if you listed all the theories.
And then whether or not, like, if the potions professor always has their office in the dungeons, or if that's just Snape's office, and if that stays Snape's office when Snape is no longer teaching potions, and if it's the same defense against the dark arts classroom used every time. The answer is we have no idea. And you know what? I know people say, like, a lot of people like, you know, Tolkien style fantasy that's got a huge detailed map, and many other fantasies do that. There's something almost charming, if we can say that it was for style as opposed to just not thinking of it, there's something almost charming about stuff just pops up.
You know, I do the, I'm big into the maps of Harry
Potter. Oh, yes.
And the way that space and time are, they, you know, they are very fluid. And I see there's a whole kind of rejection of this need for transparency. And if you think about it, I was thinking, Marissa, about you trying to make a map of Hogwarts. And of course, the map that we have of Hogwarts is the Marauder's map. And how good is this map, really? You know, I always think, like, this map, it has there's a lot of stuff it doesn't have on it. It's only as good as the people who made it. And there are all kinds of questions. And of course, you've got moving staircases and all kinds of weird stuff. You know, you've got the unplottable places. So yeah, it's a fascinating kind of question. And I agree. I think it's part of the fun of it that maybe it's hard to actually plot it out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and not just speaking of space time, Katie, it's not just space. It's also time. The Quidditch season was another one that we were going round and round in circles on. Like, how does that, what time of year is it? How does this work every year? Is there, like, what is the setup of this?
Yeah, and if you think about it, they've just got four matches a year. Is that it?
Well, no, but because we only ever see the Gryffindor matches.
Right.
But in between every team, read the book. every team has to play, every house has to play every other house, but we only ever see the Gryffindor matches. And then it seems like they're the first one of the year, but like then sometimes it just, time and space don't exist in Hogwarts.
I feel like sometimes, don't we hear about the other matches, but we don't actually ever go to them?
Mm. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So much for school spirit, right? You don't go to the other matches. There is a whole Quidditch section. And I love the corridors. I was thinking about what Emily was saying, where she would be. And Emily would be trolling the corridors of Hogwarts for sure. So you can have your handbook ready for that, Emily.
I noticed in the book, you wove together very skillfully information from the books themselves and then also information from wizardingworld.com. And I was wondering as I was reading, because I noticed that, you know, you highlight a lot of the places and the aspects of Hogwarts that were very much popularized by the movies. But I wondered about what you did with the information from the movies, especially where it might have conflicted with information or just wasn't kind of present in the books. How did you negotiate the different sources?
This is a super contentious question, even within our group of authors, because every individual has a different opinion on what is canon. and that comes into play a lot, because, you know, you may think of something as canon, but when it comes to people's knowledge of everything Harry Potter, you really are drawing from everything you know. So whether or not you consider the movies canon, they've definitely influenced how you view things. Mm-hmm. And so we did make a conscious decision throughout all of the books in this series to not use the movies or the video games, I believe, were the only two sources we chose not to use. And it was really hard, especially for the character compendium, because you couldn't use descriptions that were given in the movies. And a lot of the more rare characters, the people who are maybe mentioned on the periphery, they don't have descriptions except for in those quote unquote non-canonical sources. So it was the same with this book. You had a lot of interesting information coming from the video games or the movies, especially about paintings on the walls. And you just couldn't use that information because technically it's not canon, or according to the series anyway.
The one exception for films that we had is Fantastic Beasts, because our attitude with Harry Potter films is that those are adaptations of the books. Mm-hmm. So that's one interpretation. It's not necessarily added information. So that's why we stuck only to books there. Sometimes they contradict. Whereas Fantastic Beasts, we treated that as, well, these are the original, if you will.
That's what we've got. Yeah.
So we did use the Fantastic Beasts films, although that introduced its own problems occasionally, such as things like the Mirror of Erised became a whole big to-do. So we used WizardingWorld.com or original writings on Pottermore, other things that had come from interviews, things like that. I think usually when it was an interview, we said this was an interview. So, you know, author talking off the cuff, maybe or maybe not as legitimate. But we also used any other Hogwarts library books, so Tales of Beedle the Bard, Quidditch Through the Ages, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. But some of that Pottermore writing was difficult because some things are no longer in the places they used to be. And in particular, there was a whole thing with the Mirror of Erised, because it shows up in the Room of Requirement in Crimes of Grindelwald. And then like one of those Pottermore ebooks had listed in it, but it wasn't listed in the same article on Pottermore, the website, that it was put back in the Room of Requirement after it was used in Sorcerer's Stone, and therefore in the Room of Hidden Things, and therefore destroyed during the Battle of Hogwarts by Fiendfire. But that was only in that one place. So we had that question of, okay, are we to believe that it was destroyed, or is this just a guess and we don't actually know? So that definitely introduced some questions when using these different sources. And don't even get us started on what year McGonagall was born. I think we did decide to just say we're going off of what it says in the books, and we don't care that Fantastic Beasts rewrote it. And there was debate about whether at some point there had been a birth year on Pottermore and it had been taken off. So there are definitely inconsistencies of, you know, digital information that can be changed as opposed to something that was printed in a book, which is an ongoing issue about Harry Potter canon when things are in tweets or published online or rewritten. And we no longer have, well, this is the book that was printed that millions of people bought and we all have.
That McGonagall, yeah. She's an old soul. She's an old soul.
Yeah, so I can tell that you all, you know, you actually delved really deeply and you were probably finding out all kinds of new things about Britain's School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. What did you find out about it that you didn't already know? And what are your favorite, like, unusual fun facts?
I feel like I had read all of this information already at one point or another, just from having been in this for so long, but it was compiling certain things and getting a look at trends that actually blew my mind the most. So I did the hospital wing section and wrote down every single trip made to the hospital wing. And I think I found out from that 33 people that we know of go to the hospital wing.
Wow.
Which, so it's like, yeah, this is a dangerous school.
Jeez. Yeah.
Also, I did the list of everything that people lose or get house points for, and Snape takes points away for not helping Neville and for helping Neville.
Yeah. Yeah. I like those lists.
Yeah, yeah. It was like, just, I don't like you was right. One of them.
Oh, yeah. Malfoy took away points for I don't like you.
Yeah, just cheek. Just basic cheek.
So, what we gleaned from that is house point system is incredibly unfair.
That's funny, but like seeing it, I like that idea of seeing it, seeing the trends and so on, really opening your eyes to some stuff. I was just thinking, like, it's been 0 days since our last accident at the school.
Does Madame Pomfrey ever have a slow day?
No. I guess not. Marissa, what about you? Anything, you know, particularly fun that you feel like you learned in this process?
I was the one who put together the sample class schedule.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to put together. It was really hard gathering all of that information, and not just gathering it, but also verifying it myself. And I guess I knew, but I didn't realize how different their school day looks to how I pictured it in my head. There was actually a lot more free time, I guess you would say, laid out in that schedule. And that could definitely be because obviously we're not getting every second of the day. So perhaps there were things that we don't know about happening during those periods of time. But
yeah, like
I just
gym
thought
class.
It was so... Yeah.
We're having gym class. We didn't even know. They didn't mention it. It's boring. Just like they didn't mention math. The bathroom. You know, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe they were doing math or health class or learning something. I was gonna make a snide comment there. I was gonna say maybe learning something useful, but I suppose that's looking at it from a very Muggle perspective.
Yeah, Muggle centric.
Right.
Well, let me ask you all the question I asked Emily at the beginning, and so you all know all the places at Hogwarts really well now. If you were a Hogwarts student, Marissa, where do you think you'd be spending most of your time?
That is one of the easiest answers for me, because as a Ravenclaw, it would be the Ravenclaw common room. Oh. I just can't picture a better place to hang out.
You are a true Ravenclaw then, Marissa.
Through and through.
Lori, what about you?
I work in a library, so it's probably going to have to be the library for me. But like Emily, I enjoy just wandering and finding different things. I love a stained glass window. I do feel that I would just wander the hallways a lot, probably getting lost, and just like find a spot by a really nice window where the light's coming in. I also like cloisters. So I feel like there would just be spots like that, cloisters and stained glass windows. Where I would be enjoying myself when not finding strange books in the library.
Cool. You and Emily would be encountering each other in the corridors, and then you and I would be meeting up in the library. That sounds good.
Go hang out
with everyone. Love it.
And there's this whole theory about hierophanies, which are these like thresholds to the sacred. And there's this argument that part of the appeal of the Harry Potter books is that there's this, it gives us this possibility of transcendence in our own world. And the Great Hall is a great example of that, right? Where it sort of opens up into the heavens and you think this could be my threshold to the sacred, the magical.
because I know there's a lot of theories on how Potter can be related to religion, as well as just concepts like that of transcendence and transformation. And a lot of it applies to the magic or the character arcs, but I've never really considered applying it to the literal physical spaces. And I really love that concept.
Yeah, and one of the things, you know, that is different about it, Harry Potter's world is smushed into our own world. And so you could like stumble upon a portkey one day, right? Or, you know, you could go to platform 9 3/4, you know, and I think those are the things that give us this, we're almost there. We could almost.
That's what I've always loved about it. I had some conversation, I think like someone from my high school newspaper a couple of years ago wanted to interview me for a class that was doing something about Harry Potter in New York City specifically. And she asked me some very specific questions about like growing up in New York City and as a Harry Potter fan and like how those two things are connected. And I said like, okay, well, the obvious stuff is just like stuff comes here, like exhibits and things, and we're lucky to be in a major city. But I also said, I think so much other fantasy is, you know, like these epic fantasies that are set, you know, not in cities. It's like, you know, it's out in out, away from civilization where fairies come out in forests and things, or on the mountains and it, or quaint little towns. And this, it's not quite what I think people would call urban fantasy, but there's an element of urban fantasy.
It's embedded. Yeah.
That like trains are magic and buses are magic and thing and like stuff that's crowded into a city is bustling with magic. And I do think that had a certain appeal to me as a kid growing up in a city and not like in a small town or a rural area where like, ooh, the magic's out in the trees. It's like, no, the magic's in the city.
Yeah, it's definitely alluring for us muggles.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, we've always wanted Hogwarts a history, many of us anyway. How close do you think that this book gets us to that whole scoop? And what do you wish you knew about Hogwarts that still remains shrouded in mystery?
I think this is a little different than what I'd imagine Hogwarts a history to be, because it has more modern stuff in it. I imagine Hogwarts a history has a lot more about, you know, the 1,000 years since it's been created. And this is maybe a handier guide. You know, no one but Hermione has actually read Hogwarts a history. I think more Hogwarts students would benefit from this, because it would actually be, they should give this to Muggleborn students who are about to start and don't know anything about the school, because this is really a little more of a guide for a student. That would be handy, I think. But that said, that leads into my, what I wish I knew about Hogwarts. I have always been curious about the full story of the founding. Now, I'm very against, for various reasons, wanting any other like official canon material at this point. But if there were to be anything, I know a lot of people scramble for a Marauder story. I don't want it. I feel that it was mostly already explained in the books. The thing that I would want, and when I say I'd want it, I'll write it, is the founding of Hogwarts. I do think we know these four great wizards, and we know a little bit of background about each of them, but we really don't know, how did they all become such good friends, and what made them all interested in teaching based on their various backgrounds, and how did they get together and decide they should do this? And so I think you could have a fascinating story that I'd always be curious to hear of the full story of these people and how they created this school.
And you know, there's got to be some drama there. There's got to be some good soap. Yeah.
Well, you know, we still want Ian Desher's Shakespearean version of it, right? That was what he proposed. Yeah. So listeners, go back. We interviewed Ian Desher, who writes those wonderful Shakespearean pastiches of Star Wars and other properties. And he had proposed that, but was politely declined by Rowling and her people. So yeah, well, we still want it. We still want it, Ian. So whenever you got a free moment. Marissa, what about you?
I definitely agree with Lori that this is different than Hogwarts a History, but I feel like it's as comprehensive as it's ever going to get with the knowledge we have now. So I'm really pleased with that. And I feel really confident in saying that too. As far as what I wish I knew about Hogwarts that remains mysterious, I'm interested, and I'm not a big conspiracy person in real life. However, when it comes to Harry Potter, I love thinking about the most odd conspiracies, because sometimes those things happened to be true. Like the fact that there was a large snake-like creature, you know, a basilisk in the piping at Hogwarts right now, that
seems unlikely.
Right. Nobody believes that story.
Exactly. And I want to know, what else is there like the Chamber of Secrets at Hogwarts? Because there's got to be something. It's too old and too full of magic for there not to be something else.
Yeah, that's fun, right? Yeah, it can't be the Chamber of Secrets. There's got to be other stuff. Yeah, I mean,
if Slytherin did that, like, maybe Gryffindor had a secret room for dueling and Hufflepuff had a secret greenhouse.
And or secret room for eating pie.
Ravenclaw's got a secret library, right?
Oh, right, right.
Well, that sounds great. Well, you can tell that you had a great time putting it together. I love the comments on the back from, you know, like reviews on the back. Very fun. There's so much stuff. And I do feel like you mined all of the resources for every drop of information.
I am going to take credit for the Peeves poem on the back. I did write the Peeves poem.
Oh, you did? It's so good.
It's genius.
it's awesome.
And then that was my next Chestnut Hill paper on Peeves. I didn't realize how much of my Chestnut Hill papers were influencing my writing of this book.
Well, y'all are experts now, and you know, it really shows. And listeners, you will want to get a copy of this book. It's so much fun. You will be a master of Hogwarts Harry Potter trivia for all your, you know, wonderful trivia competitions. But also, it was just delightful. It was fun. There were lots of little fun things. There's a book of admittance. I didn't realize that. That was one thing that I was like, I don't remember the book of admittance, but that was fun. Lots of good backstory that I know everybody will really enjoy. Thank you so much, Lori Beckhoff and Marissa Osman, for talking with us about the unofficial Harry Potter Hogwarts Handbook.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us. Yeah, it was so much fun.
Great to talk with you all. Well, we are going to end today with a quote from Sorcerer's Stone, the first time Harry's class of first years enters the Great Hall. Harry looked upward and saw a velvety black ceiling dotted with stars. He heard Hermione whisper, "It's bewitched to look like the sky outside. I read about it in Hogwarts, A History." It was hard to believe there was a ceiling there at all, and that the Great Hall didn't simply open up on the heavens. Listeners, here's to all the books that help us see the enchantment all around us.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to PotterversityPodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Tao, featuring Sean Elsbond, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsbond. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.